You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Another week, another awesome interview. Do you know that you have three types of subconscious level biases that may be sabotaging you? Yeah, we're going to dig into those. And we're going to talk about my new favorite tool for getting out of fight and flight mode. It's called the 6-second rule. We're going to go into that and more with Adam Hansen. He is the VP of Innovation and an innovation process consultant at Ideas2Go and a career-long innovation leader, student, and devotee. I think you'll hear that in his answers to a lot of these questions. He almost gets obsessed about innovation and behavior, and it's really cool how he approaches the answers to my questions. He's also the author of a very interesting book called Outsmart Your Instincts: How the Behavioral Innovation Approach Drives Your Company Forward. So we talk a lot about how to kind of move away from our ancestral behaviors, our primitive behaviors that aren't really caught up to today, and how that might be holding us back on innovation and what to do about it. It's pretty cool. So buckle up. Let's go.
Adam, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So let's start with, because I'm really curious about what gets people into what they do. How did you get obsessed with innovation?
Well, I was always a creative kid. I think maybe we're going with some of the birth order theory stuff here. I'm the last kid, you know. But there's something really primordial, I think, really elemental about creating. And I've just always loved it. I was always drawn as a kid to In various mythologies. I was always drawn to the creative forces versus the destructive ones. And I remember early on, I was really fascinated with, like, when I found out, like, the earliest story that we knew about was, you know, the Babylonian story about, you know, the Enuma Elish, and this story about, this heroic story about redirecting chaos creatively. And then just, you know, learning that, hey, we're that strand of DNA that can confront our environment and can both imagine something better and then apply our will to create that something better. I just think that's amazing. It's not just fun, which it really is, but, you know, getting a little grandiose here, it's really heroic. And I think that's what innovation is all about. I think ultimately there's something heroic about it without getting too grandiose here.
So you just said something that I just want to stop and kind of pause on, because I think it is so important about we're able to imagine the future, different possibilities. Why is that so important? I think not just in innovation, but also in life.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about any other life form, no one else gets to do that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's, we have both that capability, but I think certain responsibilities come along with it then. Because we can do that, a failure to do that when we could make something better for our, you know, for ourselves, for our families, et cetera, it kind of gets thrown back onto us. And I think we have to kind of confront, well, why didn't we do that then? If we could have done that, maybe there should be some reflection as to why we didn't. And I mean, we can always play that game. And I don't think we should all spend a life fully soaked in regret. But We should just be aware that we always know, without going to a motivational poster here, we're always far more capable than we will acknowledge. And we just need to be about the business, I think, more of creating. And I just don't think we would be in the position that we are as a culture of all the infighting and so many of the problems that we have if more of us really fully understood this great story of we are where we are because we are first and foremost creators.
I just had this wonderful image of one of those 1980s motivational posters on my wall with your, like, we're capable of so much more, jumping up to the moon, touching the moon or something.
Oh, we are. We are. And we sell ourselves short every day. And I implicate myself as much as anyone, certainly.
Do you think that being part of being innovative is recognizing or at least taking the risk in trying to do more than you're currently capable of, or at least recognizing that you're capable of more than what you are doing? Because innovation is oftentimes about pushing the boundaries, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's, as an innovation professional, I think it's kind of on you to, well, let me back up. I think it's... I think you gain authority when you author. And that doesn't just mean write books, that means create. And so I think the root of authority is author. And I think for me personally, I have a tenuous relationship with authority. And it dawned on me the only kind of authority that I'm interested in is in those people who have authored something, who have created something, who care enough about a domain that they've internalized what has been there before, but then they love that domain so much that they say, hey, I want to make a contribution here. Mm. And so I'm going to bring my thing to it now. And then I go, oh, that's great. I mean, that's, again, to me, I find that heroic, and I want to see more of that. And I want to then make my contribution as well. I think if you love an area enough, it's kind of on you to then not just, kind of ape everything else you've seen there, but then actually bring your own thing to it and add to the body of work there.
So I want to dig into this whole area around, you know, our ancestors and how that impacts how we act today. And you wrote a whole book around this, Outsmarting Your Instincts, and we'll put that link in the show note as well. And, you know, I was reading a Forbes article that you were interviewed in, and you talked a lot about our innovation behaviors and how they come from our ancestors, I think especially risk aversion. Will you talk about that and how our ancestors are impacting how we innovate today? This whole thing fascinates me.
Yeah. You know, it's so easy for us to get caught up in our day-to-day pressures and imagine that what we face is a normal part of the human condition. And historically, it's not. It's really what we're going through is profoundly different than what everything in our history up until this last moment required from our ancestors. And so when conditions don't change much or at all for millennia, you know, certain adaptive behaviors nestled in. And so when survival was the big win daily for 99.999% of our species history, it shouldn't surprise us too much that what those behaviors that are still so well ingrained in us now, you know, don't set us up really well to deal with the conditions that we face now, which are so radically different. So risk aversion was a great thing for our ancestors because survival was the big win every day. And of course, survival is not necessarily the big win for most of us now. We need to move on. And what brought us here won't get us to where we need to go now. In fact, those behaviors are actually very, really maladaptive now. So we need to just be aware of what's going on. And just our bodies are still wired for caloric scarcity. And it's caloric overabundance that has most of us in trouble.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
We still have in our brain also these shortcuts that really served our ancestors especially well. But we haven't, you know, evolution takes a long time to catch up to the conditions, you know, on the street. So we just need to be aware that same thing is going on in our minds so we can then do something about it. So, you know, we're still wired for the Pleistocene era, which wrapped up about 11,000 years ago. And so, you know, things like negativity bias, availability bias, confirmation bias, those are three of the eight biases that really hurt innovation. They're non-conscious, which is also a problem then because we come up with really smart sounding rationale for why we're doing certain things that really work at cross purposes with doing innovation right. But we need to be aware of it so we can then start to do something about it. You know, like, as I say in the recovery movement, you know, awareness is the first step.
Right.
And then you can get to work on it.
Will you say those three biases again? I got confirmation. I want to make sure I got the other two.
Yeah, so negativity, we list it as the first one because it's just so outsized. And it just looms so largely in our cognition. So negativity bias is the idea that bad is stronger than good in our cognition. And so we know, so for example, you know, from customer service, we know that it takes something like 7 or 8 positive mentions of a company to overcome 1 negative mention of a company.
Right.
Right. And you can see why historically this it's tied to risk aversion and loss aversion, right? And so that was really helpful. That was good to our ancestors. If all novelty was identified first and foremost as threat, then that was probably good. We didn't have to worry about things. Oh, that's new. Danger. Let's get out of here. That's new. Hey, that's opportunity. Those people who way back then had that bent, they probably didn't stick around very long, and they didn't get a chance, as much of a chance, to pass on their DNA. So we are the descendants of the real savants of risk aversion. And so that's negativity bias. So availability bias is the idea that we make decisions. Most of the decisions we make, we have to make very quickly. In fact, most of the decisions we make happen so quickly, we don't even register them as decisions, because they're really, I mean, they're just boom, boom, boom. I mean, they're reflexive, they're automatic. And we don't have to, really don't have to attach a whole lot of significance to them or put a whole lot of time to them. And that's great, and that's very efficient. But some decisions really do bear a little bit of consideration. But we will make decisions based on what's most quickly summonable, and what we pull up is usually not most representative. It's not usually the best criteria or the best it's not really what we would want to have to consider, and particularly if we're trying to do innovation work. If we took just a little more time to bring in some better stimuli to help us do that work, we'd do a little bit better. So that's availability bias in the research. Daniel Kahneman, his phrase for it was, what we see is all there is. And we believe in a very real way that that's what's going on with availability.
What a great way to say it. What we see is all there is.
Yeah. And we honestly believe it in a real way that is what it is.
It's kind of like, before we go to confirmation, I just say it's kind of like, you know, the solution in front of me is the only possible solution to this challenge. That's because what I see is all there is. When in reality, to what we were talking about in the beginning with our ability to imagine new possibilities, there's a million other options out there. We just have to think about them.
Oh, absolutely. And we too often just set up decisions as only A or B, very binary, and we just go to it. And more, you know, often that's fine because the consequences aren't that huge. So great, you know, but that's availability. And then confirmation bias is just the idea that once we believe something to be true, we'll privilege all information that supports that, and we'll figure out a way why all disconfirmatory evidence doesn't really apply.
Yeah, and we do it
non-consciously, which is the real tricky part about it.
So how do you catch if it's unconscious? How do you catch yourself in those moments? Because I totally buy into what you're saying about confirmation, negativity, availability, that those biases totally get in the way of our progress, and in innovation in particular, when you need to stretch yourself. So how do you, it's so ingrained, how do you catch yourself?
Well, it's just one thing, again, is just awareness, just knowing that we're prone to them, so that the more you remind yourself of it, and then so... You know, what's been great about this, and what's really been wonderful about all this, is I've been on this now for, you know, a couple of years. And digging into this has not made me superhuman. It's made me humble. Because I just catch myself all the dang time, you know, lapsing, you know, going into it. And you know, Daniel Kahneman in particular wasn't particularly optimistic about us being able to overcome these biases. And I guess I'd have to say, you don't necessarily, they're primordial, they're wired. I mean, they're part of the machine, but that isn't to say that we just wash our hands and say, well, that's it. Nothing can be done. Well, of course something can be done. They're there, but attention, awareness, and then, you know, some having a framework and some tools to deal with them can really send you a long way. So once you're aware of them, you can start to see them popping up in yourself. You certainly can start to see them popping up in other people, because it's always easy to do that, right?
Yeah.
We can always see the faults in others much better than ourselves. And so then you just start to see that and you go, oh, I see what's going on. That's negativity bias. That's availability bias. That's confirmation bias. That's confabulation. That's a curse of knowledge, whatever. And then you go, but what it does, hopefully, and this is what we really want to have happen here, is that it never places you in a position of judgment. It places you, hopefully, in a position of humility. And hopefully you bring a little bit of sense of humor to it. And you have colleagues who can go on this journey with you. And you just kind of link arms and help each other.
Dig a little bit into that, what you mean by this position of judgment versus humility and how that impacts your ability to innovate.
Well, so there's one thing that kind of goes, is tied in with a lot of this. It's called naive realism. And we kind of spoke about, it's kind of tied to this notion, what you see is all there is. And naive realism is the idea that how we see the world is actually how it is. And of course we know that that's just not true. And so just even understanding that can be helpful. Jonathan Haidt, a really wonderful researcher and professor, said that he nominates naive realism as the number one obstacle to world peace and interpersonal harmony. And if you'll just remember that more frequently, you'll go. When you're having that argument with a loved one or with a friend or with a work colleague or anything, you go, just understand that you don't have the stranglehold on complete reality. And that's not to say your part of the puzzle isn't important and you should always be a doormat, just that the other person also has an important part of the puzzle here. And you need to hear him or her out. And that together, that's why arguments can be helpful if you negotiate them right. And you can pull that together. And high performing organizations have high trust and high conflict. And you should have both, but the conflict isn't nasty and personal and, dumb, but it's saying no, a diversity of opinion is absolutely vital to do innovation right, because each one of us is finite. Each one of us can only grasp a certain percentage of the overall picture.
So will you dig a little bit into that? I'm fascinated by this part of, one of the things you talk about is being a big believer in creative dissent and that's actually a good thing.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, kind of what you're saying about trust and conflict. And I love this idea of those two together. But talk about that because, I'm sure you hear this all the time in innovation. It drives me bonkers. It's like, well, there's all these naysayers, so I just ignore them. Or, I'm looking for the people who really love my idea. But the truth is that that's bad too, right?
Well, it's we're not building a cult. So yeah, get over yourself really quickly. And ego should be checked at the door, and that goes for you as the innovator. It's this notion of agreement or dissent too early on is just weird. I mean, it really is a non sequitur. I mean, early on you want to come up with lots of ideas and you don't want to start, premature agreement can be really harmful. And so I'd say that setup of agreement or dissent really is just a non sequitur. And so language that kind of came to me a while ago, which is just kind of weird, but in the sport of javelin throwing, we're not overly concerned about courtesy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not judged on courtesy in javelin throwing because it just doesn't apply. And so agreement or dissent too early on in innovation is just the wrong way to think about it. You want breadth of ideas. And so senior leaders can really model this well. And if you start to notice that everyone is too quick just to do, even if people go, okay, we're going to come up with lots of ideas, but you start to notice that all the ideas coming in are just the thinnest variations on what, Georgina is putting out, then we have a problem. And Georgina needs to say, as a senior person in the room, hey, this is great, folks. Let's try to stretch a little bit more and let's go even further. Good so far, but we need to come up with a lot more variety. And one of the dimensions of creativity is range, and not just having lots of ideas, but lots of different types of ideas. And so getting senior leaders really to buy in on this, and that everyone just kind of affirming them, is really not the point.
You know, I love that we're talking about this because I think, you know, whether you're a entrepreneur inside, you know, innovator inside an organization, or you're an entrepreneur, we often make the mistake of, because we take it so personally, we put our ideas out there and we're looking for the people to light up because we want validation that whatever it is we're putting out there is a good thing, right? Don't call my baby ugly. Like, that's the worst thing you could possibly do. And I will tell you, you know, Adam, I'm so glad you mentioned all this, because personally, as a, you know, small business owner, I realized that when I gave my team the permission, really, to disagree with me and poke holes in my ideas and find better ways to do things, that the ideas that we were putting out there, the execution was 100% better than it would have been had everybody just yesed me to begin with. And but I had, as a leader, I needed to really own that and give people permission, because we want to be liked and we want to have good reviews at the end of the day. So it's, yeah, it's easier said than done.
Well, absolutely. And it's when you have the right perspective on it as a leader, you realize that by passing the mic to the rest of the crowd, you actually become a stronger leader.
That is true. And
that's what real leadership looks like, you know, and that's where you want to go. And it's back to the, you know, the African proverb, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Yeah.
And so you really want that. And again, it gets back to this idea that the perspective of any one of us is necessarily finite. We can only individually take in so much of reality, and we are going to miss some really important parts of the puzzle, no matter how smart we are. We have to get others involved.
You're so right about that. And for launchers out there listening, what Adam's saying here, I think, is so important of, you only have a piece of the puzzle to move that idea, to get progress, to a piece of reality. So if you allow other people to add that piece of the puzzle too, you get a much better picture. Adam, what's that old saying? Something like, there's three sides to the truth. No, there's three sides to every story.
Yeah.
Yours, mine, and the truth.
And the
I totally
truth.
Botched it up.
Yeah,
I gave it away in the beginning. But
that
kind of reminds me of what you're saying of, you know, hey, you've only really got a piece of it at the end of the day.
Well, and the truth is, we can have eight of us, and we're only then maybe slightly beginning to close in on what the truth might be.
That's right.
And we're still falling short, you know.
That's so right. So I want to kind of wrap all of this around and put it into kind of the day-to-day application, because we've talked a little bit about, you know, all these different biases and trust and conflict, and, you know, really at the end of the day, the time that we live in is a small drop in our lifespan as humans. And for a long time, to your point, we were just surviving. And, you know, you had talked about in that article, just to kind of loop it back, about, you know, that person who took the risk and went out in the bush to try to find some new food, or, you know, find a new thing to hunt, probably got eaten and never came back. So risk was not rewarded the way it's potentially rewarded today. But, you know, I was trying to bring that in my head when I was reading that back to an experience I had recently, where I was in a new business meeting. This client was thinking of bringing me in to do some innovation work. And he asked me a question that set me on edge. And I, like, fight or flight kicked in. And I froze. I started to sweat a little bit. I started, like, I wanted to run. Like, my body was like, get out, go, move while you can. But, you know, I had to sit there. So how do we do it? How do we take this fight or flight, ancestral, all these biases that are built in from a time when it mattered or it worked for us, to now and deal with it? Because, you know, I shouldn't have run in that meeting, although I wanted to. Yeah.
Well, again, it's just the awareness. So our predator detection system is still operative, right? And it's blunt and it's not finely calibrated. It makes no distinction between slight embarrassment and tiger.
Yeah.
right?
Exactly. That's my moment right there. Like, that slight on edge kind of rude comment that this person made me feel like I was about to be eaten by a tiger.
Yeah. And it's not, you have no control over it. And so there's this term that I love that's called the amygdala hijack. And so it's the amygdala now in our brain kicks in, and that's the really primordial part of us. And, you know, activity is shunted away from the prefrontal cortex, and we really become dumb, because it is, resources need to go to, the amygdala takes over resources, because this could be an emergency.
Yeah.
And higher order thinking isn't the most important thing right now. Because you may need to get your butt out of there, right?
That's why I didn't have a smart answer in the moment because...
Well, of course. So there's some really great work being done by a group. It's 6seconds.org that I'd like to draw your attention to. I met a guy at the Business Innovation Factory Summit a couple years ago named Paul Stillman. And they say 6 seconds can be the difference between emotional intelligence and, I guess, the converse, emotional stupidity.
Yeah.
And so you can't, it's maybe tough to do in a meeting to take 6 seconds just to breathe deeply and arrest the emotional hijack. But what it speaks to is even there, this really primordial, the body just doing its thing and kind of taking over on your behalf because it feels like there's a threat to safety here. And again, that threat isn't distinguished. It's blunt. It doesn't make the distinction. But we can arrest it and we can gain back. And increasingly, I think what we're learning here is that we probably need to reclaim the term emotional intelligence and realize that it's just intelligence.
Yeah.
And increasingly, I think I'm seeing this more and more, and that intelligence, kind of shorn of emotional intelligence, really kind of looks as dumb as gypsum. And probably to do innovation well, we probably all need to become more emotionally intelligent and have better tools for being able to access that and making sure that emotional intelligence is informing, every step of the innovation work that we're doing.
And do you think it's fair to say that emotional hijacking that happens in those moments is actually hindering innovation in your team, in yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Because think about, and if my experience, well, my experience is always going to be somewhat, non-representative because, we all have that. But I now, working with Ideas to Go now, I've been able to work with lots and lots of, companies over the last 16 years. And I guess I get a more representative sample. And we know of some of the tough conversations that are going on inside, Fortune 200 companies. And it's too much of this is coming down to these primordial cognitive biases. And too much of the conversation is happening at the level of kind of like the limbic brain. And so decisions are made based on non-conscious biases that are largely, kind of limbic brain kind of things. And it's getting in the way of the prefrontal cortex being able to do more of its good work.
Okay. I think, Adam, two things here. One is, I think here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a 6-second challenge. And I challenge all the listeners out there when they have that moment where they feel, that their primal instincts have kicked in to pause for 6 seconds and breathe before they respond to the person on the other side of the table, the phone. And I would venture to say, if you just give a, let me think about that for a second, 6 seconds actually won't seem that bad to the person on the other side. It seems more to you than it does to them. So that's my challenge. And then I want people to comment to us about how it went, because I'm going to try it for sure, because I know I've got some tough conversations coming up. Because I, you're right. We just got to get our control back when our primal kicks in. It's so instant that, like happened to me, I started sweating right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And the great news is a little bit of awareness, and in this case, one simple tool can really make a pretty big difference. And that's the great news in all of this. I mean, this is overcomable, if that's a word.
Phew, it is now.
It's surmountable. It's surmountable. There's the word. I'm from Idaho. English isn't my first language.
It's pop versus soda, right? Isn't that the other difference?
That's right. I'm from pop country.
Yeah. It reminds me of, so I used to do a bunch of innovation work for Pepsi, and they're a great company. They have really smart people, but they had a tough time with innovation. you know, in the time that I was working with them. And I would venture to say that part of that was there was a lack of this trust and conflict at the same time, which I think is a very cool way to say it. But one of the things that they used to do that didn't work, I'm kind of throwing them under the bus, sorry, Pepsi, but I think this was a cultural mistake, is they taught people to use certain language when they ask questions. So we would be running these, you know, creative brainstorm sessions to come up with what, to your point, should be a range of ideas. And someone would, in an effort to ask a question that is probably poking a hole or saying, I don't agree, they'd say, I have a clarifying question, or I have an inquiry question, or I have a summary question. They taught them all these words to say so that the person on the other side of that question would feel more at ease when the person was asking. And what I saw in the room was exactly what you and I were talking about, is our primal instinct kicked in because we knew that that meant, I'm about to disagree with your ass.
Oh, yeah. And the clarifying question or the summary question, whatever, might have been just a really smart way of yes-butting the hell out of
it. Exactly. But everybody knew it.
Yeah. Well, and so here's the other vexing part of negativity bias, what the research shows, and which comes back to highlight how irrational we are. And that is that negativity is at the same time automatic and appears really smart.
Oh.
And so those two things just should not coincide. I mean, you shouldn't get points. You shouldn't get smart points for something that's reflexive. And yet the research shows that, you know, reviews of that were really negative got points for sounding really super smart, even when, you know, kind of later the reviewers themselves weren't. No, the reviewers themselves were viewed as being really smart, even when later, upon reflection, the reviews themselves weren't seen as being all that helpful.
So when you're the smart, snarky person taking everything down and like bucking status quo all the time, you're seen as smart, but truly you're not contributing.
Well, and we know, I think we all know people who've made careers out of this.
Yeah.
And it seems really smart, but man, when you really think about it, it's really irresponsible.
Yeah, that's really, I had never really thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. That person always, in my mind, just personally, was always the cool person. I was like, why am I not clever like them? Damn it.
Yeah.
I'll never be as smart as them. You're absolutely right. I would do that all the time when someone's all super snarky and irreverent. How funny. I have a total negativity bias and I didn't even know it. See, that's how great these things are.
Yeah.
It's funny. Now, next time, though, that person talks, I'll pay attention to actually the content of what they're saying, and maybe I'll have a different perspective. I want to switch gears a little bit because there's one thing I want to make sure to ask you about before we run out of time, and that's about adventurous framing, if I said that right, of a challenge, about how the power of framing your challenges, problems, the things you're trying to tackle in a more adventurous way. Talk a little bit about what you mean about that and why you've seen that to be of such high impact.
Yeah. Too many innovation teams, people working in innovation, lose the early opportunities to innovate. And so when you frame your challenge or your opportunity exactly as your competition would, as the rest of your category would, you know, think about what you're doing. You're agreeing to the rules of the same game that everyone else is playing. So you've non-consciously signed up for a raft of assumptions that will hem you in. You've already given away degrees of freedom about design, customer experience, route to market, value drivers, etc. And like, what did you get in return for, for
giving away? Everybody else got.
Yeah. And so when you tee up your challenge differently, you will necessarily come up with different ideas. So one quick way is to put yourself in your customer's shoes and fill in this blank multiple times. I'm not buying blank. I'm really buying blank, with the idea that all products and services are only benefit delivery vehicles, and really thinking hard about what great benefits your customer would really, really love to get. And then, again, nobody buys products or services because they're just enraptured with the product or service per se, but what those do for them. And so taking a step back and constantly being on the hunt for just fantastic benefits, what your company can really do for them, and really challenging everything that goes around those benefits, the entire experience, everything about it, you know, how those benefits get to them, That's what it's all about. So when you frame your challenge differently, when you don't accept the terms of the game, and you get really creative from the very beginning in how you're setting it up, then you're really going to think about it, the entire process differently.
Will you walk through that example? Give us something real world. So I'm not buying blank. I'm really buying blank. Will you walk us through that? I'd love to hear how it actually plays out.
Well, so I think here's a great one, and you can agree or not with the quality of the end product, but what's been happening in the pizza wars the last couple of years, and you know, I live in New Jersey, so I'm probably going to get kicked out of the state because you know we know what real pizza is like here, but
yes, you do.
You know, Domino's. You know, did a decent upgrade in the quality of their product, you know, probably about 4 years ago or so, but realized, hey, that's still not good enough. What is the entire experience around our pizza? And they made a massive investment in IT, in the whole app, the whole experience of ordering through the iPhone or the, you know, through your smartphone app or your, you know, your tablet app or whatever. Pizza Hut didn't do any of that. And Domino has been experiencing, you know, kind of year on year gains of like 12%, you know, while Pizza Hut has been, you know, languishing. Pizza Hut's been, I think, been losing about 4% a year for the last couple of years. And so, you know, Domino's, I mean, look, I think, again, I live in New Jersey, so I know what real pizza is. So I guess it's hard for me. I don't know that I would be able to tell much difference in the pizza quality between Domino's and Pizza Hut. Sorry, Domino's. Sorry, Pizza Hut. But the entire experience around that pizza now, I don't think that Domino's saw that their next big gain was going to be through another reformulation of pizza or just coming out with different types of toppings. I think they said, let's think about what's the entire benefit bundle around pizza? And how can we think about that very differently? I'm not buying pizza. I'm buying the entire experience from when someone first thinks about buying pizza to taking a bite.
So then would you keep going on that? So like, okay, so then I'm not buying just the experience or the experience. I'm buying, the flavors I love delivered to my doorstep.
Yeah. Again, so that's beautiful. So just like anything else, when you first come up with lots of ideas, then you can be really smart about which ideas you pick to come forward with. And that should be just as true about your purpose statement for your innovation as it is for the products, the product ideas you generate as well. So the whole process is come up with more ideas that you can use and pick the best ones to move forward with. When you keep doing that diverge, converge throughout the entire process, you're going to come up with better ideas. And that should not just be in the product or service ideas themselves, but even earlier when you're trying to land the right purpose statement for your project.
So kind of like I'm going to use fitness for a quick example because I think it's just an easy one to hold on to in your brain. It's kind of like I'm not buying a treadmill to run on every day. I'm buying the opportunity to prove that I am a healthy, fit person because that's my identity.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And so now that you have that, consider how that really changes what that entire experience could be about. And now I've gone from feet hitting a belt to everything that's going about it. And now I'm starting to consider how do more of my senses become involved in that experience?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Under Armour, I was just recently reading an article about them. It was fascinating. You know, their huge rise and, you know, we know them for their clothing, their wicking clothing and all that, but their whole thing is to make athletes better.
Yeah.
That's their vision, their mantra, everything that they serve. And because of that, they really thought about, all right, you know, I'm not selling clothing. I'm selling a tool to help this athlete perform better. And when they thought about that, that took them to new innovations around community apps. They've got a whole apps things like with hundreds of thousands probably people on it. But that helped drive their innovation because they understood that first fill in the blank wasn't actually what they were about.
Yeah. Now, it wasn't bad that they first landed it where they did.
Oh, no, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. But so it's back to, have you ever heard, Jeffrey Moore, the kind of the Silicon Valley strategist, mm-hmm. Came up with, have you ever heard his bowling pin strategy, which is great, which says, think of what that head pin is that you need to knock down first. Mm. And in doing so, it makes it all the easier to knock down the 2 and 3 pin behind it. And then, the 4, 5, and 6 pin behind them and et cetera. And so, yeah.
I love that for launch shooters listening. I am going to start thinking about, and I hope you do too, what's the head pin I can tackle today?
Yeah.
That could get 2, 3, and all. It's 9, right? Is that right with bowling? I don't know. I bowl with the bumpers, so I'm the wrong person to ask about bowling. But I like the analogy quite a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. What's, kind of in our, as we're wrapping it up, I can't even believe the time's gone so fast. What's one piece of advice you would give to launch readers around how to unlock more of that innovation and how to outsmart their instincts, as you talk about?
Well, I think, I'd go back to negativity bias. I think if you solve for it, it makes it a lot easier than to get on the path to working on these other cognitive biases that are slowing you down. So you're going to go straight to what isn't working and something new that comes up to you. Even when you're coming up with your own ideas, it's easy to go straight to, here's the problem with that. And so when you say, you're always going to be able to come back to what isn't working. So don't go there first and say, what am I for in this idea? And the more you can think about ideas early on in the process, here's a metaphor for you. Ideas early in the process are vehicles to help you get to yet better places, not end destinations in and of themselves. And if you can just take that, that's going to do you really well when you're trying to come up with lots and lots of ideas. And that will get you some real momentum going. And the more you can consider ideas early on for their provocative value rather than for their immediate merits, the better off you're going to be.
Wow, I have to say that's very freeing to think about it that way of, hey, look, we're going to come up with all these ideas because we know they're vehicles to something better. We don't care about these here. We're just going to throw them out there to get to the next place.
That's right.
Yeah, that's great. And maybe some of them move on, but wow, how freeing to not have to worry about that out of the gate. Yep. All right, so Adam, where can people go to get your book, Outsmarting Your Instincts, and to connect with you?
You can check us out at www.ideastogo.com, ideastogo.com, and outsmartyourinstincts.com. You can check me out at Ad Hansen, A-D-H-A-N-S-E-N, on Twitter. And we can connect there. And then I'm the luckiest man alive. I get to do this for a living. It's ridiculous. My single greatest fear is that someone comes and taps me on the shoulder and tells me I have to go get a real job.
No.
So I am happy to talk to anyone about any of this stuff. I find it tremendously interesting and inspiring. And I just want to make innovation the wonderful, joyful, inspiring experience that it really should be for everyone.
It's a great way to say that. So final question, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? It could be a hobby, experience, passion.
So this has an asterisk by it, but I have opened in a band I was in, I have opened for Hootie and the Blowfish and Smash Mouth with my favorite band ever, The Unsaleables.
Wow. I would have not guessed. I mean, I don't know you well, but that's not one that I would have been able to pop out as a guess.
It's a long story, but it was fun. It was a blast. I mean, again, you're doing it. You're going, I did not see this happening either.
So, is that when you're on the stage thinking, am I really here?
Yeah, it's very fun.
That's very cool. Adam, thank you so much for coming by to Launch Street. It was really an insightful conversation.
Tamara, thank you so very much.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.